You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I'm a visiting fellow here at the Center on Europe, and I'm sorry that Fiona Hill and Andrew Moffat, who lead the center, are not with us today, and they are both traveling. But I'm delighted to see so many people today to hear our distinguished speakers. It is a privilege to have Ambassador Laurence Tubiana, Special Envoy Todd Stern of the State Department, and Brookings' own Bean Antolis here on stage, all of whom have a wealth of experience and expertise on one of the most critically important issues of our time, global climate change. Let me say that Ambassador Tubiana's presence at Brookings could not be more timely. Last month, the New York Climate Leaders Summit was an important step in the climate governance process. The issue has practically spread to all areas, including security. This week in Washington, the Pentagon issued a powerful report on the impact of climate change, described as a climate change application adaptation roadmap. The report suggests the Pentagon will work alongside with the State Department and that the United States should work with other countries as well. In about 13 months, from November 30th to December 11th, 2015, Paris will host the United Nations Climate Change Conference, which will be the 21st session of the Conference of the Parties to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, also known as COP21. A special team has been set up, and it is led by Laurence Tubiana, who brings with her years of knowledge and experience as an academic and climate change expert, especially through the Institute for Sustainable Development and International Relations she founded. A professor at Sciences Po and at Columbia University, she chairs the board of the French Development Agency and was appointed in June 2013 French Ambassador for Climate Change. Sitting next to her is Todd Stern, the U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change. I'm pretty sure he's met Laurence Tubiana before, but considering their tight schedule, we're quite lucky to have them together on the same panel. Like Mrs. Tubiana, Mr. Stern should need no introduction, but I would just add that he has an impressive track record as a climate change and environment expert, notably as a senior fellow with the Center for American Progress, and as a White House senior advisor. As for our moderator, Bill Antolis, you probably know he's Brookings Managing Director and the co-author with our president, Strobe Talbot, of one of the real go-to books on the evolution of climate change as a national and international issue. You'll find it at the bookshop next door. This is the 11th Raymond Aron Lecture at Brookings. This annual event is named after a celebrated scholar of post-war France, a professor of political science, economics, religion, history, philosophy. In other words, a scholar who embraced a wide range of critical issues of the days and the policies that put them into practice. This conference tries to reflect on Aron's teachings and thinking, and over the years we've hosted speakers such as Pascal Lamy, Robert Zelick, Stephen Breyer, Tony Judd, Jean Pisani-Ferry, Olivier Roy, Thérèse Delpech, or Sandra Day O'Connor, among others. So it's an honor for us to be able to call this lecture the Raymond Aron series in his name, and to add two more notable names to that already impressive list, like Laurence Tubiana and Todd Stern. As architects of our future, perhaps they will reflect on the following quote by Aron himself. "The man who no longer expects miraculous changes, either from a revolution or from an economic plan, is not obliged to resign himself to the unjustifiable." Before turning the podium over to Ambassador Tubiana, I would like to thank all of those who have contributed to make this event a successful one. We're indebted to the Embassy of France for their tremendous collaboration over the years, and I recognize here Ambassador Gérard Rao, who is here with us. And I want to thank the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Development, and in particular, the Policy Planning Unit, which is now led by my predecessor here at Brookings, Justin Weiss, and now Ambassador to Vienna. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Philippe, for this introduction. It's a great pleasure and honor to be there and to continue a long-standing conversation with companion in face of this very difficult challenge. I find it rather fitting and encouraging that this lecture, which has explored so many pressing topics of transatlantic cooperation and global issues, choose to focus on climate negotiation in 2014. I'm not sure, however, Monsieur Raymond himself, Professor Raymond Aron, would approve of this choice. As a die-hard realist, he probably wouldn't have had much patience with the technicalities and complexities of the UNFCCC process. It's fairly easy to imagine him greeting the disappointment of Copenhagen in 2009 with a shrug and an amused, "I told you so." At the same time, Aron has a profound distrust for ideology, all form of ideology, perhaps would he recognize that the advocates of infinite economic growth are the new ideologues, and those who point out the finiteness of our planet are the new realists. But let us not get carried away so soon from the core topic of the day, climate governance and the preparation of the Paris Conference next year. I come to Brookings first and foremost as France's ambassador for climate negotiation and special representative for this event, but also as an academic. And I'm glad that the format allows us to take the time to elaborate on a few examples and indulge in a bit of theoretical thinking. In fact, at least for an academic like me, theory helps many times when problems appear. And many times I have really built my ideas on the shoulders of academic, and in particular of this country, like Robert Putnam, John Ruggie, Klaus Rostiala, and many others, that in this intellectual, as really intellectual companion in this bumpy road of the negotiation. But I speak today, most of all, as a passionate observer of the climate negotiation, who has worked in and around them for many years and is determined to see them deliver a strong agreement, just as Todd Stern, who I'm glad to share the floor with today. You know, most of the people who are working on climate change become addicted. It's an addiction. I don't know if it's as dangerous as alcohol or others, but it's very difficult to get rid of it. As you were well aware, the UNFCCC process has been often described by critics, and with some reasons, as painfully slow and unnecessarily technical. I hope, and I'm sure Todd, together with me, we try our best to ensure that the same adjective will not be used to describe this lecture. I will elaborate on three main ideas today. First, climate governance have been defined so far by a few institutional successes amid of an overall failure to escape the prisoner dilemma between states and to define an adequate role for the non-state actors. Second, the New York Climate Leaders Summit, after many events, starting from Johannesburg, the summit in 2002, has revealed profound change in the governance, namely the perception of climate impacts by nation states, the tone of the global conversation about climate disruption, and the emergence of the middle ground between North and South and the involvement of non-state actors. And third, I will share, of course, because that's what, of course, interests you, some thoughts on how the Paris Conference, like at COP21, can give birth to a Paris Alliance for Climate and shape the contour of a new and more effective climate regime. First off, the climate governance, it's worth remembering where we come from. As most of you know, governance of the environment originated mostly from the combined pressure of scientific findings and social movements. On the scientific side, we know the several thought leaders began to sound the alarm on the finiteness of the planet and its natural resources. Richard Carson led the charge with Silent Spring in 1962. Club of Rome followed with Limit to Growth in 1970. And on the civic side, the 60s and the 70s saw an unprecedented convergence of convergence of environmental concerns with other social movements. Environment protests grew more massive and frequent throughout these days. On Earth Day of 1970, more than 20 million Americans took the streets, which led to the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency and accelerated the birth of modern environmentalism. This country has seen the birth of the global environment movement. That's why, and Todd knows it, of course, and it's good that he is on board, I think we need really deeply U.S. and to really stand together, not only because of its economic and military power, but because of its intelligence, capacity, and innovation. The 1972 United Conference on Human Environment, remembered today as the Stockholm Conference, marked the first eruption of the environmental issue in international relations. Reading the Stockholm Declaration today, more than 40 years after its adoption, that remains both astonishing and enriching. So the notion of a global governance is not used. The foundation for it are very clear. All the disorders, resource management issues, and polluting activities were already perceived as the element of one single international collective action problem. However, the Stockholm Conference was probably too much ahead of its time. It took 20 years exactly before the 1992 Rio Earth Summit institutionalized the environment and sustainable development at the international level. With its strict convention on climate, biodiversity, and desertification, Rio was the first draft of a roadmap for global resource management. From there, the production of coordination frameworks started to speed up. About 500 to 700 multilateral environment agreements have been signed since the beginning of the early 90s. Among this institutional proliferation, climate change has always held a special place. We could talk about an exceptionalism of UNFCCC compared to the sister Rio Convention, hundreds and hundreds of other environmental-related processes. The climate talks gained almost from the start considerable more attention from national government, non-state actors, and media. When the Kyoto Protocol was signed in 1997, close to 4,000 journalists already were present to witness it. The exceptional character is best understood in comparison with other environmental conventions. First and foremost, it's the magnitude of the challenge that explains this. It is about transforming the energy base of the global economy, a transition from a cheap fossil fuel-based economy to a low-carbon economy free from fossil. Ozone layer was a very much limited challenge and about mainly readily applicable technical solution. Climate change doesn't have that kind of silver bullet solutions. That was the same for the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, which is a good example of reasonably successful multilateral agreement, but it's mostly technical, and while climate really is about sustainable development, thus carrying heavy social and economic consequences. This added to the fact that the greenhouse gases is a stock problem and a systemic impact are to be perceived by following generation, this makes it a very unique negotiation. Kyoto was an historical first step, and it remained an important precedent, though it was not nearly enough in terms of how many countries it gathered and the kind of emission it mandated. Unfortunately, climate negotiations were not spared by the general decline of political will on environment governance in the early 2000s and the return to traditional vision of international politics. In part, the famous phrase of Madeleine Albright saying, "Multilateral when we can, unilateral when we must," became the other way around. Unilateral when we can, and multilateral when we cannot do everything else. That was why, for many years, climate seemed bound to remain a case in point of the prisoner dilemma. So the benefit of early concerted action were known. The lack of trust and fear of free riding prevented serious progress. Classical state-centric diplomatic method didn't seem capable of delivering the kind of cooperation required by this challenge. Throughout the 2000s, climate governance resembled very much what Robert Keohane calls a regime complex, a loosely coupled set of specific regimes, but without the coordination of political will that Keohane himself very strongly say it can't make up for this complexity. Copenhagen talks in 2009 can be considered as the first and final attempt to build a top-down, integrated and comprehensive climate governance. But there was no common vision as to how this governance could look like. The participation of head of states and government added, for the most part, an extra layer of complexity. Compromises were reached partially, painfully, and without the transparency expected in UN negotiation. This proved that a purely state-centric method and the hope that the climate challenge could be met in one big summit with the one stroke of the pen were bound to disappoint. Copenhagen was a shock for most actors and observers of these talks, myself included. But it created the dynamics we see today. Local authorities and companies, frustrated with a lack of progress, began to take leadership without waiting for signal from the states. And the states themselves, having experienced the limits of the top-down format and the importance of the transparency and inclusiveness, resumed the negotiation on a healthier basis. Copenhagen was certainly a blow. It wasn't a knockout. From COP to COP, the process dusted itself off, picked itself off. One couldn't help but see constructivism at work here. Cancun secured the advance of Copenhagen, from the Green Climate Fund to the 2C degree goal. Durban launched a new roadmap towards a global agreement in 2015. Doha extended the Kyoto Protocol to prevent a legal void and also gave way to a very innovative compromise to prepare for COP21. Instead of holding their cards firmly in hand until the very last minute, countries, and they have accepted that, will announce their contribution to the future agreement by the first quarter of 2015. All of these advances taken together are beginning to shape climate governance in a unique and successful way. They are putting order and harmony in Kyoto regime complex. Paris will have to be a critical step in these efforts, as I will explain a bit later. But first, I wanted to point out that climate governance is a remarkable and an unparalleled learning process, which always went back and forth between the substantial question, its urgency, and the modality and implementation procedures of solution. It remained deeply influenced by national interest, of course, and at times corporate interest. It's about power, politics, and even sometimes ego politics. It has so far failed to deliver the kind of ambitious action that climate science recommends, but it is also the proof that knowledge changed the perception of national interest, and that by this way the process has demonstrated tremendous institutional creativity. This was particularly visible at the Climate Leaders Summit in New York. The New York Summit has revealed and achieved many things. I will linger a bit on these lessons to be drawn from it, not only for what it delivered, but because it revealed an important and accelerated change that are starting to shape the future climate regime. In my opinion, and there were four main trends. The first trend is the increased saliency of climate impacts in the speeches of head of states and governments. Very few of them didn't mention the extreme weather events and slow onset disasters they were experiencing back home. The sense of here and now, which was so far almost exclusively expressed by low-lying island nations and other vulnerable countries, is becoming mainstream. And your country, US, is a perfect example. This means that the mindset of most countries is changing. Securing the statu quo and going home empty-handed after a COP is not as valid as an option as it used to be. A very good example is China. I'm a member from now to more than 10 years of the China Council of Environment and Development, who reports to the Prime Minister. Now it's the third report from the Science Academy of China that reports the immense magnitude of the impact of climate change for China. From this, we saw Chinese leadership totally change their vision of the problem. The second trend is a shift on the global conversation on climate toward a more positive tone. 2006 turn review of the economics of climate change highlight powerful evidence for climate action by estimating the cost of inaction, thought to be 5 to 20 times greater than the cost of moving to low-carbon economies. But we were missing an important piece of the puzzle, the benefit of action. This is what the new climate economy report helped demonstrate in New York, That's why many people name it Stern Report 2.0. This also goes in the sense of reinforcing the here and now in terms of climate impact. The benefits of low-carbon investment will only be felt in two generations, but the positive co-benefits for health, employment, and economic activity could be felt now. The third trend is the emergence of a middle ground between North and South. Let us be clear, the North-South divide is still alive, but the lines are moving. For several years, we have seen the emergence of middle-income countries as deal brokers. Green Climate Fund is due to intense diplomatic efforts to Mexico and Norway. Colombia has done a lot to launch what we call the Cartagena Dialogue, able to try to bridge position between North and South. As host of COP20 this year, Peru will also seek to play that role. Other countries are now joining in. The announces of Costa Rica and Ethiopia to reach carbon neutrality, respectively by 2021 and 2025, which is really an impressive announcement, it is really a very, very good sign. There is no longer a taboo regarding net emission reduction by developing countries. It's unprecedented. This is the main advantage of the bottom-up dynamic. We now have a clear and increasingly vocal majority of countries moving in the same direction, though not yet, of course, at the same pace. The fourth and final trend is increasing role of non-state actors in the climate governance. This concerns primarily the organized civil society, NGO, business community, local authorities, network, which were prominently featured in panel discussion and voluntary multi-actor initiatives in the summit. Such organizations have been on the sideline of the negotiation for 2 decades, but that's the first time they actually took center stage. How this will translate in the classical UNFCCC format, it remains to be seen, but that, for example, one part of the discussion at Lima in 2 months. I believe this will be a long-lasting legacy of New York Summit. Another aspect is the participation of citizens themselves. The turnout during the climate marches exceeded by far the organizers' expectations. Of course, we are not at the 20 million, but there were 400,000 people in New York and many others in other countries, summoning memories from the 60s and 70s. Instead, the salience of the presence in the summit was also due to the reluctance of many governments to announce too precisely and too soon commitments on finance or mitigation efforts. Again, local authority, businesses, investors wanted to see they can go ahead without waiting for the government. So what can we draw out for finding a good framework for Paris? By pointing out this trend, I hope I've been able to convey a sense of what made the New York summit inspiring. I understand the critics who point out that the summit didn't produce really concrete deliverable as we could have hoped for. But France is there and convinced that COP21 can help harness this positive trend and translate them in something more institutionalized. We can bring this energy, work towards a strong outcome. As we see it now, I see the agreement or the compact we are looking for in Paris with 4 pillars. One is the more essential one, is the agreement itself. This is the heart of the Durban mandate and the main result France will be judged on as a presidency of the talks. Without preempting on the negotiation in Lima and Paris, we can already start forming a picture of what this agreement could look like. It would need to be flexible enough to accommodate future change without having to be renegotiated. It's a long-standing agreement framework. At the same time, it would need to usher in a clear set of common rules to build accountability and trust. After Scott Barrett of Columbia University and my colleague, we know that environmental agreements must be deep but narrow or broad but shallow, but we must be the exception that confirms the rule because we need a universal agreement, but one that sets the stage for a deep decarbonization of our economies and create the collective dynamic to contain warming under 2C. The second pillar, which is a core as well, is a national contribution. I was mentioning earlier that the Warsaw Compromise is a good example of the exceptional creativity of the UNFCCC. Its ability to channel the tension into innovative way forwards. The intended, and excuse the jargon, the intended nationally determined contribution you see there. precision process, can get countries to think of what's good for themselves instead of what is good for others. This can be a fruitful change for perspective. It's not no more. The challenge here will be to take this contribution, aggregate them into something that makes sense as a whole, and especially assess whether this puts humanity on track to stay under 2C, or it will need to accelerate. We have to shift the discussion from a discussion on targets and fetishism of a number or a zero-sum gain of burden sharing to a discussion of the content of the transformation of the low-carbon economy and its drivers and the necessary international cooperation to achieve it. We need to shift the negotiation from targets and number only to pathways. For this, and we have as well, and that's why France is sort of encouraging country to give a global view on the more long-term perspective by 2050. So, as we will not have one signal, we will have many. We have to have a movement to understand the movement of policies pointing to the right direction. Kyoto was about having a single global carbon price. Paris will be to have a multitude of policies, integrated carbon price, integrating carbon low carbon economy measures. So that's very different way, but it is in a way an informal and more formal coordination of the policies. What is important is the sense of the travel. We have to travel upward to put us on the right track for the 2-degree goals. And of course, it is that what we are looking for. The third pillar will be finance. There is the immediate issue of mobilizing finance for the initial capitalization of the Green Climate Fund. And of course, we hope and we are very sort of reassured on what the contribution of US, and we know that will be critical. Beyond that, we will also need to address long-term question, how the transparency and efficiency of climate finance can be reinforced, what can be counted or not as part of a $100 billion climate finance per year by 2020, which was a pledge that we made in Copenhagen, and how the leverage of public finance on private finance can be maximized. The objective, the ultimate goal is, in a way, simple, is to redirect finance flows, which are now massively investing in real estates and government bonds, to the low-carbon economy. The objective, as well, is simple as well, is how to decrease massively the cost of the upfront capital, which is necessary for this transition. So we have many channels to do that, but finally, that's the outcome we are looking for. The fourth pillar will be the multi-actors initiative launched or showcased in Paris in direct continuation with the summit. It's worth reminding that some of these initiatives were launched in reaction to the NFCCC process and its perceived slugginess. Now the goal is to reconnect them to the convention so that it can act as a mothership for all these parallel initiatives. All of this will imply stronger measurement and follow-up to avoid the shortcoming of the Rio Plus 20 voluntary pledges, but the advantage of connecting this initiative with the convention is that they can lean on a well-established process with regular meeting and a strong secretariat. At Lima, we will try to see if we can create innovative platform for reporting accountability of all these new actors. That's really as defining a new DNA for global governance. This pillar, and of course we have to build relationship with other processes that are not particularly non-governmental, that's the case of the Montreal Protocol, for example, but has proved to be a useful tool to fight climate change. It could be also synergies that we can create with WTO negotiation and the Sustainable Development Goals, negotiations that will be ended by September 2015. But this possibility for the moment have been barely begun to be explored. But what is important is about embedding the climate regime in a global sustainability framework. More importantly, and with this I will conclude, it is useful to imagine these four pillars and why, but how do they support themselves? What is the overarching objective? Here, the expression of France Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius can provide an answer. The notion is an alliance, a Paris alliance for the climate. a coalition that would extend to all non-state actors willing to do their part to secure a safe climate future and to be accountable for this. The goal is not to dilute responsibility, encourage double counting, or transform the UNFCCC negotiation into a collective happening that would relieve nation states of their essential duties or strip them of their prerogatives. But we must acknowledge that climate negotiation concerns not just diplomacy, but also the way we produce, we consume, and the way we build and thrive. Raymond Aron famously said that the soldier and the diplomat were the two players in international relations. This simply no longer applies to the world we live in today, to the magnitude and the nature of the climate disruptions. Aron remains celebrated today as one of the most lucid thinkers of his time. One can only assume that this lucidity would lead him to recognize the growing body of evidence on the severity of the climate crisis, the necessity of global cooperation. Alongside the soldier and the diplomat, we must now associate the entrepreneur, the mayor, the research, and the citizen. This is why France's vision is for COP21, to lay the foundation for a shared ownership of the climate challenge. Thank you for your attention.
Wherever you'd like to go. Wherever you want to go. Well, while Todd is either wiring or standing, whichever he'd prefer, I think he's going to wire, let me just say it is a real pleasure to be here today with three dear friends and friends of many years. The two people seated on the stage with me who have been great friends for a long time, as well as mentors, and the person whose lecture this is named for, who I never knew but I've known longer than these two people. I read Raymond Aron as an undergrad and a graduate student, and consider him at the level that great authors are, to be not just a mentor but a friend. So with that, I'm going to turn to a mentor and a friend, Todd, for his and co-author for his response.
Thank you very much. Can people hear me? Great. Well, first of all, thank you very much to Brookings for having me here. It's a great pleasure. Thanks to my friend. I was going to also mention my colleague and co-author back in the day, and great friend Bill Antholis, and my dear friend Lawrence Tubiana. Also, I wanted to say for a moment that I love that little Raymond Aron quote at the beginning here, because I heard it as being about pursuing pragmatic action and about pursuing the art of the possible, knowing that the perfect isn't possible, but pushing to get as much as one can get, recognizing the imperfections that we all live in. Laurence and I go back a long way. I don't know how far back, but it seems like a long time ago, and there are few people on the international climate scene that I have appreciated more over the years than Laurence, both for her insight and wisdom and for her friendship. And I think we are lucky, those of us who work on the international stage on climate change, we're lucky to have France in the presidency of COP21 for this very pivotal time. With the enormously capable ministerial leadership of Laurent Fabius and the also enormously capable day-to-day diplomatic leadership of Laurent. So I think we are very fortunate for that. As we could expect, I think Laurent has just delivered remarks that were extremely interesting, thought-provoking, astute, creative. Let me put my own gloss on a few of those, some of those same subjects, and sort of my take on a few of those things. First, I entirely agree that international is just one part of the equation, and we need to look at action that's taking place on many different levels. I entirely agree with Laurence, and I actually had the opportunity to speak at Yale a couple of days ago, so I was focusing on some of these same issues. But I entirely agree that the fundamental mission that we're all on is the transformation of the global economy from high carbon to low carbon, And everything that we do in international negotiations, in domestic action nationally, at subnational levels, everything that we're doing with respect to climate change really has to be seen through that lens in service of that mission. I look at, I think, your comments, Lawrence, made me think about sort of how I think of the architecture between international, national, and subnational. And I guess I still look at the national nations, the national actors, as the most pivotal players in this drama. I think that states have the capacity to do policy and to mobilize resources at the scale that's needed, to set the rules of the road in place, to put incentives in place, to remove barriers, to fund the R&D, and to spur investment, to do things at scale without which we can't solve the problem. I think you move down from the nation state to subnational level, to cities, to states, to civil society, and two things happen at that level. You have action that happens, substantive action that happens, that is very real and very important. You have, you know, California taking the leadership role that it has taken with its cap and trade program. The Reggie states in the Northeast, in the U.S., you have all sorts of subnational action going on Bill has written about in India and in China and other places. So there's real action happening, but it's also, when you move down below, you also are getting the political will that ultimately drives the countries and national governments, federal governments. And when you have 400,000 people take to the streets in New York and steal the show for the Climate Week, that's political will that's getting exercised, and that is, along with a great many other developments going on in our country and others, is the place that will drive us, I think, before too long to a tipping point in our politics, which we certainly need. Regarding the agreement itself, I think that we mostly know what needs to be done. I think the players in this negotiation mostly know what the deal is to be had. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy to get there, because it's not. But there is right now a bottom-up, essentially nationally determined structure that's been put forward, as Laurence talked about, for the commitments that countries would make with respect to reducing or limiting their carbon emissions. There is that's kind of the critical starting point. There needs to be, and there is a lot of discussion about, I think a lot of understanding about, the elements essentially of an accountability system that will allow all of us to know clearly what countries have put forward, and then to track the degree to which they're implementing what they say they're going to do. And there's a number of elements to an accountability system, which starts with the clarity with which the initial commitments, as Laurent said, the term of art in these negotiations right now is contributions, but we're essentially talking about commitments. To have clarity on what they are, to have rules, norms, expectations that are built into the agreement, so that everybody can understand what needs to be done with respect to accounting and other elements of the regime. There needs to be a regular regime of updating the commitments that are made. So if we have commitments that are made now, let's say, for a particular period of time, the U.S., we think that it ought to be till 2025. There's some debate as to whether it's 2025 or 2030, but whatever it turns out to be, or it turns out to be some hybrid, there needs to be an understanding that we are updating progressively ramping those commitments up every X years. We think it should be every 5 years to get maximum ambition. The point is to be creating a stable, durable agreement that we are not going back to renegotiate every 5 years or every 10 years. We want an agreement now for the decades. I think that there is also an understanding about the singular importance of adaptation. Laurence talked about this also, the greater reference in New York to the climate impacts all over the world. Adaptation is the thing that probably 100 countries or more think about a whole lot more than anything else, because many, many smaller and poorer countries don't emit very much yet. But they certainly worry about the impacts of climate change. So adaptation is enormously important, and we basically have to do two things. It gets a lot wordier when you get into the actual language of negotiations, but fundamentally we're talking about better planning and better funding to implement the plans. Those are the two things that need to happen. And I think that there's quite good progress that has been getting made over the course of the last number of years, really, with respect to adaptation, but there's more that needs to be done. Financial assistance is sort of the other pillar. So again, think about mitigation with all of its various elements that I was talking about, and accountability and all of that, adaptation, and then various forms of financial assistance. Again, a lot of progress that has been made. We are working hard on the Copenhagen commitment among donor countries to mobilize $100 billion a year by 2020 from all sources, public and private and so forth. The U.S. leads a donor coordination effort, which we started last year with a bunch of other countries, probably about a dozen, to work through all of the different channels that exist now, the multilateral development banks, the development finance institutions, and others, to improve and lift up and increase that mobilization. And even more important, probably, at least for the immediate, is that the Green Climate Fund, which was first called for in Copenhagen, has a location, it has a headquarters in Seoul, it has an executive director, it has a staff, and God willing, on November 20th, it's going to have an initial capitalization. So there is a lot of progress that is being made. November 20th, because that's the capitalization meeting for the board of the fund. So there's a great deal of progress, and we basically know what needs to be done. There are big impediments still. Countries are not at all in the same place on some very important points. Maybe the most important being the issue of differentiation, which I think maybe we'll talk about a little more in a while. I'm sure I'm over my time, right, Phil? Am I over my time? Getting there.
You're getting close.
Okay, so I'm gonna wrap up, and just make the following point that if we can get there, it will be a big deal. Again, it's not going to be the unified field theory, grand comprehensive treaty that will solve climate change forever, because that's a charade. That doesn't exist. But what we can do is get an agreement that is more ambitious than ever before, that genuinely is applicable to all, not in some formalistic way. And sometimes I hear countries say, well, you know, the Kyoto Protocol is applicable to all in a purely formalistic way, but not its obligations. So we're talking about an agreement that would be really applicable to all, that would be fully differentiated in a manner that's essentially self-differentiated, that countries decide what they can do, built on a foundation of solid rules-based accountability that elevates adaptation, that encompasses a large-scale financial commitment, and that sends a potent signal to the global community, from boardrooms to governments to civil society, that countries at the highest level are committed to this fight. And that would be a big deal, and it's an opportunity. We need to seize the day. We need to not let the theological debates that sometimes dominate in the UNFCCC drive us off the track, and get this done. It's obviously enormously important. for dealing with climate change. And I must say, I think it is enormously important for the UNFCCC as an institution that it succeed now and that there not be another perception of failure. So I think we can do this.
Okay. Terrific. So I'll ask a couple questions. We'll get a conversation going, and we'll then turn to you. So after, say, my second question, think about your question, raising your hand. And when we turn, please put your questions as questions, not statements. Tell us who you are and where you're from, and direct them to either Todd or Laurence. So I'm going to start with Laurence. You laid out pillars. You used a building metaphor. Give us a sense. There's a famous American politician, Richard Gephardt, who once described getting a global climate agreement as the most complex political transaction in the history of mankind, because essentially we're regulating a sixth of our economy, and 190 some odd other countries have to do the same, all at different levels of economic development. You've got a little more than a year to pull all of those 190 something countries together around your five pillars. How do you think that through? How does shifting from a construction metaphor to a travel metaphor, what does that road look like, or what does that path of construction look like? And maybe even what are the metaphorical frameworks for building the package, since you sit in the chair, just to make your life a little easier?
Thank you, Bill, to relieve from the pressure.
Trying to lower expectations.
That's
for you.
Exactly. I think many people, just when they see me, they say, oh, you have a very interesting job this year. I think that's the easiest job on the planet for 2015. I'm convinced of that. I would try to explain the vision through probably the 12th of December 2015, when we'll finish our job. My sense is that what we are looking for, and that's the indication for the road to take, is in the communique, I would like to see a phrase, and the phrase would be the low carbon economy is there. It's marching. We have it. We will have it. That meaning that I think, what is about Paris is about building a framework, something that will discipline the countries with the goal, the 2 degrees. But managing the expectation of many, many, many actors, which is really making this expectation on the low carbon economy converge. That is what we are looking for Paris. Then the road has to be really to try to build the rules that will discipline, again, the nation states, as Todd, I agree, is at the core. And this rule-based system has to really be solid. So it has to be super clear, even if we cannot finish everything for Paris, but I think the main elements have to be there. We have obstacles in front. The obstacles are, I think, the sense of inevitability that we have to create, that the country doesn't have other choice to agree on something which is at the same time ambitious and pragmatic. And this sense of where is equilibrium between pragmatism and ambition has to be more or less the same in 1 year's time. As Todd said, everybody knows more or less where the landing point is. The issue is how much, what kind of cost, political cost or political benefit the different countries will have to accept this more or less anticipated landing point. And that, I think, that's the work we have to do, to just country by country, in a way, or even with whatever force we can, just make government understand that this is the time. Again, Todd is right. We know what the agreement is about. We could even draft it very quickly now. But the problem is really now to balance the benefits, of course, and the costs that each country has to face, and just that they think that it is inevitable. The only way is to talk during all this year, and to have a method that brings inclusiveness with specificity. We haven't talked, we'll do that this tomorrow morning, of how his advice is on how to conduct the informal discussion and the formal discussion throughout next year. But I do think that we have to innovate in the method. Some have done, the Mexicans have done before Cancun. At the same time, having a small grouping of countries trying to define what is really the more important thing for them, and then have a sense of the balance between the different trade-offs. Still, we have the main conflicts. Should the commitments of the country be legally binding internationally or not? That's one of the lines. We have many other lines, but there are these big things. But in reality, what is much more important than this, which is rather theological many times, is what is really at stake for Bangladesh or for Mali or for Kenya or for Ethiopia or for Costa Rica or Colombia or for Mexico. And that we have to really work on the substance more than on the procedures. So I see the line as a really giving a lot more, I would say, substantiate the discussion as much as we can. Because, again, no, everybody sees the pillars. Some would like more legally binding, some less. Some would like more ODA finance, some would like less. So it's really a problem of balance. So I see really trying to create this inevitability will be our main task, and talking to each of them with a lot of transparency. So being informal and being very transparent.
Todd, bridging process and substance, thinking about just even the last few months, the UN Special Summit, President Obama's meeting with Prime Minister Modi. He has an upcoming trip to APEC. He'll meet with Xi Jinping. So there are roadmaps. There's a road with rest areas for the president if he's going to be raising these issues, and he's obviously been raising it. He raised it with Prime Minister Modi. There was a strong statement there, particularly on the issue that you alluded to and you talked about in your Yale speech, common but differentiated responsibilities. How do you see some of those pieces coming together over the course of the year? How do you see, in the process of the president's own diplomacy and of your diplomacy, the conversation about the role of developing countries in a new regime?
Well, I guess I'd make a few points. Maybe I sort of take the two things a little bit separately, although they do overlap. But the president has been, the White House and the administration generally has been tremendously engaged, I think, engaged in the first term, certainly, but from the time of the inauguration and the second term, tremendous level of engagement by the president and raising these issues with foreign leaders. Important, probably the most significant deliverable, if you will, coming out of the Sunnylands meeting last year with Xi Jinping, his president's first meeting with the Chinese leader, that was on climate change. That was followed up by another dance with Xi Jinping a few months later on the margins of the G20. As Bill said, the president just had a very good meeting, I think, with Prime Minister Modi. So there is, I think, real engagement in a whole host of ways by the president. The developing country, the split, the fault line between developed and developing countries has been the biggest impediment to progress in these negotiations, I think, over the last 20 years. I mean, it's been the most difficult issue. And on a speak at overly great length, but you can understand the kind of genesis because climate change is, as you've said, Bill, it's not an environmental problem. I mean, it is that, but it's hugely tied up with entire economies. I mean, it's fundamentally about the burning of fossil fuels. That's how you run economies. So that has everything to do with growth and development and eradicating poverty. So traditionally, if you talk to developing countries, I'm not saying this is true right now, somewhat true, somewhat not true, but certainly traditionally, the concern was much more about what are you going to make me do about climate change than about climate change itself. And that's completely understandable. So the notion of CBDR, common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities, I think was fundamentally meant to say we've all got common responsibilities to be sure, but we're going to have to differentiate with respect to who does what, because there are all different levels of capability and circumstances throughout the world. And again, it made perfect sense. The principle still makes sense as long as it's interpreted the right way. The only place where we get into trouble, really, is with the essential interpretation of the phrase as involving a kind of permanent separation of the two categories of countries as they were established in 1992. Known in the lingo as Annex One for developed countries and non-Annex One for developing countries, and they are still to this day, and I would submit, still the most difficult challenge that Laurence and I and everybody else trying to get this deal is going to face, is that there are many, many, many players who say that those two categories from 1992 are essentially eternal. They are immutable. You cannot change them, and yet they also must determine the form and content of a new agreement, even one that's going to take place 30 years after 1992 and last for decades. Well, that's completely—it's irrational and it's not doable, and it can't be done. We couldn't be part of that. But there is still that concern. The answer to this is fundamentally on the table, because the self-differentiated structure completely protects everybody. No country is going to be forced to do something that they don't think, by their own assessment, they can manage based on their own circumstances and their own capabilities. So that completely understandable concern is addressed by this structure. So again, I don't want to go on at overly great length, so I'll stop there, but it's a big, big challenge. But there's an answer on the table, I think we'll get there. But this is the toughest piece, I think.
Ron, do you want to talk on that point, and then we'll turn to the audience, or
just briefly, because I think Todd has said most of what is on the table and how it can be solved. Of course, part of it is a political games. About really playing games with this notion, when in reality most of the developing countries are just fed up with this in a way. But of course they are keeping this, many of them are keeping this hostage for finance, or for, to be clear, for engagement of the developed country in this, in a way they are right to do so, because we will see if really we are industrialist countries serious about the road. I think one aspect is, and talking to India, you know well as well, Bill, the response of India can put CBDR many, many times on the table, and at the same time is asking for innovation and technology. So it's the two faces. If we can really, which in a way, like for decreasing the cost of capital is one main outcome we have to look for. The second is really to get this technology of low-carbon economy cheap and there, practical, available, and cheap, at least much cheaper than what they are today. And that, I think, is the substantive response to the theological discussion. I have a very interesting discussion with a Nicaraguan minister of environment and energy, a sort of a tough guy, very, very able in the CBDR sort of management. And when you talk to what he's doing at home, he's doing classical public-private partnership to get its electricity mix really functioning, and in particular developing a renewable energy portfolio. And this guy is, one side is innovation, capital, how I can get credit, and how can I really borrow with cheap interest rate to do that. And the other side, of course, he would talk CBDR during hours, and he's laughing sometimes about that. Like the Saudis are laughing when they address. So we have, in a way, to just say, let's discuss on the substance. Let's discuss. That's why I think it's important, even if the framework is important, even if the clarity and transparency of the commitments are important. We need the actors there because we need to give substance to the real discussion of the transformation. I think that's the best way. And at the same time, that make perceive the countries that they have a lot to gain if we work together. Working together on renewable energy will cut the cost even more than we have today. And that's something which is in the air, but can really be landed in the discussion, I feel. And I have talked about technology, but one of the discussion I would like we have is on the technology development in the in this alliance.
Right. So why don't we go to questions? And I see Brookings alumnus Scott Moore. No, excuse me, behind you, Scott.
Hi, Scott Moore from Council on Foreign Relations. I was struck by, this is a question to both panelists. I was struck by the prominence that both of you gave in your remarks to subnational actors and initiatives. And I would just wanted to ask if you have specific thoughts on how better to kind of coordinate those initiatives and subnational actions or to provide more points of access for subnational actors within the UNFCCC system, which, as you also both emphasized, remains very much nation-state-centric. Thank you.
Yeah, why don't we take a couple different questions? So here, and then we'll take one more round.
Hi, Jean Boucher from George Mason Sociology Department. Someone asked a complex question, I guess. So, Todd, you mentioned that burning fossil fuels is connected to growth and our economy and development and all these things, and you also mentioned differentiation. We're also dealing with historically high levels of inequality, both nationally in between nations and within nations. And I'm wondering if we're going to get, at some point, I mean, climate change is not our only problem. We have problems with our oceans. We have problems with biodiversity. Are we going to get to a point where we're rationing in a way, or are we somehow deciding how we're going to share this finite planet we live on?
And here in the second row.
Hi, Lisa Friedman from ClimateWire. Thanks both of you for doing this today. Question for Todd on Green Climate Fund. We're hearing from more and more diplomats that the U.S. is sending them signals that there will be a pledge to the Green Climate Fund. I think you sent kind of a signal a moment ago saying, God willing, it'll be capitalized. But just clearly, will the U.S. pledge to the Green Climate Fund in November? How much? And will this money have to, do you expect, go through Congress? Or is this something that the administration is looking for a way, as with other things, to somehow work around Congress?
You want to take those three?
I want to ask Lisa if she's got some way to get money that doesn't go through Congress. If there's a way to get money that doesn't require Congress, you got to tell me. But I'm not aware of that. But we can go in a more
sure
fashion.
Do you want to?
Maybe on the first on the question, very interesting for me on the subnational. I think that's very important that we have this subnational action and, in a way, vision. That the same that we are looking for the countries, that is, their targets and their policies, the explanation of the policies on their roadmaps, on the pathways, even on the long term, is, I think, a central element to give the signals to the businesses and to the market that something really is happening in terms of public transport, clean vehicles, electricity storage, or efficiency in buildings. And this is about the plans of at the state level as well. And why it's important is, of course, because in many cases, the states or the subnational can have more ambitious targets when they are convinced of what the possibilities and the innovation there than the national level. And that's not only the case in U.S., where, of course, we see that, but it's a case even in Canada. Take Canada. The Quebec has a vision of a low-carbon economy, which for the moment the Canadian government has not. And even when you look at China and India, you have provinces that can do better or will want to do better with different reasons because the governance is different. So that's why we need them, to give the sense of the travel, of the possibilities. And that gives, again, a signal stronger than what the government can do by themselves for the moment. how to land that in the agreement. We have to discuss that. And we don't have that much time because it's a big innovation. And we have to invent something that is not there. We don't have, I must say, I think, models to do that. So in Lima, the prospect is to try to create an institutional platform that where the non-government, even if states are government, the non-nation states could report and create a sort of accountability. At least is what I would look for. I don't know what we'll get in Lima. If we don't get anything in Lima as at least a process to do that, it will be more difficult to have something anchored from the state level or the city levels to the agreement. But I would see, I haven't discussed that with my colleague, so I don't know what he thinks. But I would see, in even in the legally binding agreement, the legal force instrument, we should design a place where at least we relate this action to the global route, the travel that is designed in this framework. But we have to invent something. And I think that's why I count a lot of the Lima talks to do that. There we could have a methodology, accountability systems, and not only declaration of the state, but something like more organized. Still, we don't have all the actors there, and there is a lot of work to be done. So that's add the pressure to the rest. And maybe I can just comment on the growth and use of natural resources. I think this trade-off between consumption of natural resources and well-being, which is translated in our mainstream thinking, growth, economic growth, which in many cases is needed, is something I think the climate talk will not resolve this equation, which has to be resolved, because we cannot just follow the path we have been following from the past. But that's why I'm really interested in the linking between the discussion on the sustainable development goals and the climate goals. That's the first time we can discuss sustainable development and climate embedded in this. It's something interesting that we could have this discussion in just after Rio, and that finally we have a set of sustainable development goals and targets that really are trying to delink well-being and the use, increased use of natural resources. It's a route, again, it's not done, but it's I would see very much a chapeau of the Paris Agreement referring to these sustainable development goals. That would be the way to think that development is not about consuming more natural resources and to try to really reinvent our development pathway. That is what it's about, because you take fossil fuel, it's water, it's nitrogen, it's phosphorus, it's many other things. We have to do the same. I don't respond for U.S. pledge. You would like me to respond?
Well, I think it is really on both sets of issues. Well, Todd, why don't you go?
All right, just a few quick comments. I don't have much to add on the subnational issue. I think what we're seeing in the climate context, and also, I was in at Rio Plus 20 a couple of years ago, and you also saw a tremendous participation from non-state actors there. There was a whole big focus on that. I think there's more and more desire for that from the ground up, and I think more and more need for it. And Lawrence is exactly right. There needs to be a platform, a mechanism created. And I think that's one of the things that probably the French presidency and friends and other countries that we will certainly be part of trying to think that through want to try to make happen. The issues of resource depletion and resource use are very real. Secretary Kerry hosted a big oceans conference for the first time this year. I think there's going to be then another one, not hosted by the U.S. but I forget who's doing it now, but another country has stepped forward to host another one next year. rationing is a very tough deal between countries. I mean, whether you can do that sort of thing within a country is a different story. But anything, I mean, I know in the climate context, once you start talking about how are we going to create a budget and then carve it up and distribute it among countries, as a negotiating matter, you're just pretty much dead. So it's really hard to do that. But the issues involving resources, water, oceans, climate, and they're in many respects the central issues that we're facing. But I think conserving and finding ways to not deplete it is in ways that don't involve. I mean, when you're talking about international action, ways that don't involve actual rationing are going to be a better bet. On the Green Climate Fund, it's a very important moment that's coming up next month. There's a meeting of the board going on right now. Board is from the 13th to the 17th, so it's still going on. There are some important decisions that are still being made there, important issues having to do with essentially how the fund will operate and how it will provide funds and in what way. We have every expectation to be part of the capitalization, but I don't have any sort of formal statement about that, and I certainly don't have any formal statements yet.
I don't envy these two on this issue of sub-state, because if you just think about, Laurence represents at some level the European Union in this process, right? And they negotiate as one in the framework, but they are however many independent sovereign states, whereas in the U.S., and the challenge in the EU is implementation at the state level, hasn't been negotiation, as we've seen in the Euro crisis on that EU agreement. In the U.S., we now have a domestic process to get states to act, and now it's the U.S. going out and representing 50 states. So even the comparability of states within any one of these systems is challenging. When you think about India and China, it's different in each of those places. So it's a big, complex issue. In the way, way back, my kid's favorite movie, and then Paul Bledsoe, too. Get the back of the room in.
Thank you so much. So my name is Lihiona. I'm with Dartmouth College and Sustain Us, which is a youth policy advocacy organization. And as you may know, this is a question for both Madame Dubian and Mr. Stern. So as you may know, it's very difficult for civil society to engage in COPs, especially for youth, and especially as accreditations are diminishing. So I'm curious as to what you see as the potential leverage points for civil society, especially youth, to engage in the COP process, both in Lima and on the way to Paris.
I see Paul have his hand up. There are a lot of, not just friends on the stage, but lots of friends in the audience.
Thanks, Bill and Brookings, for hosting, and Laurence and Todd for all your time. I had a specific question about the HFC phase out and the importance of getting an HFC phase out ahead of Paris or sometime around Paris. And also how important it is that India has now agreed to allow for negotiation of an HFC phase out under the Montreal Protocol, but for it to be accounted in the UNFCCC process.
Are we going now?
Yeah. Why don't we do that when we have about 10 minutes left, and then if we have time, we'll do one more round.
Well, to the first question, I will let Laurence speak to how youth is going to be accommodated in Paris. I actually can't speak chapter and verse about exactly how it works. I know, though, I can tell you that I met with a group of students from Dartmouth College, if I'm not mistaken, last year, I think. I think it was in Warsaw. I'm a graduate of Dartmouth College,
I was going to make sure we had full disclosure on the stage.
I was going to say full disclosure, and I gave a speech at Dartmouth College a couple of years ago. But there are ways in which young people do get in, and I think that if you just think, sort of step back and go to that issue of the political tipping point, which is going to come one day in this country. We're not there yet, but it's going to come. And it's partly going to come driven by generational factors, because young people have more at stake, have more to lose by inaction and more to gain by action. than anybody else. And that's just going to continue with every, you know, wave of young people. So I mean, of the major speeches that I, you know, I give one or two big speeches every year, and many of them are at universities. For that reason, I think that obviously critical and should be part of the COP process, and how that gets managed exactly, I can't say. On Paul's question, we think HFC phase down, not phase out. Let me get the word right for technical and politically important reasons. Phase down is really important. HFCs are fairly small part of the puzzle right now, but they are on a very rapidly rising trajectory. They are industrial gases that were created to as a substitute to ozone-depleting substances, but it so happens that they are hugely polluting from a global warming standpoint. We have been pushing now. We are among the leaders, the U.S. with Micronesia and certain others, have been pushing for a phase down to be negotiated in the Montreal Protocol. The reason for the Montreal Protocol is that's the ozone-depleting substance convention. It's a very successful one, and its reason for being is to phase down, or in some cases phase out, industrial chemicals. So they know what to do. There's a fund that provides assistance to countries to do what they need to do. They've got the expertise, and they've got the jurisdiction. What we've said is HFCs will continue to be accounted for in the UNFCCC, which is appropriate, but the UNFCCC has no expertise in this area. So it's already a few years ago that we had about 110 countries sign up to do this. There are some that have been reluctant. That agreement that I mentioned a little while ago between President Obama and Xi Jinping last year, that was about HFCs. And more progress, as Bill and Paul both alluded to, between President Obama and Prime Minister Modi just last month. There are still a number of countries that are very reluctant, but we're working it hard. It's an important thing. The first step is to get a discussion going. The formal term is in a contact group in the Montreal Protocol. That's where you get the discussion going that can lead you to an amendment. And we're working it hard there. We are also, by the way, taking action nationally. We can't do as much as we could do if we had a Montreal Protocol amendment, but we are doing significant things here.
Laurence, we've got about 5 minutes left, so I think I'm going to turn to you for final closing comments, and then we'll thank the crowd and get a nice French meal.
Thank you. I don't have, of course, to add on HFC. It's a very important point, and address that. Young people, civil society in Paris, one, I think, and that was the exercise. We are launching several exercises for different universities. In particular, Columbia University is together with the Sustainable Development Solution Network, is launching, I think, a simulation of the negotiation with a MOOC course. And we are in Sciences Po launching a simulation of negotiation with many universities as well. So one is really to begin to be part of the game and understand what is the type of agreement the young people would like to see. The second will be to have a strong place of the civil society in Paris in December, but before having a constant discussion with the different groups and movements. the presence will be in the same place, not outside, so that's an important element. So and will not have a division between a place where very far away where they will have no connection. So we'll not repeat Copenhagen setting, we'll not repeat even Cancun setting. Everybody will be, if they want, on the same place. And of course, organizing the linkages. Still, we have to invent the type of dialogues of discussion we need to, because in a way, the young people will be the one who will evaluate on the 12th of December the result of all this. The judgment will come from the media, the judgment will come from many circles, but finally, the evaluation of it, the sense that we failed or we succeed, I think we will be made by this young generation. So that's what is important to know, to understand, to explain as well what we can do, because we have to be but how much the road is really clear. That's what I hope for Paris, to have this capacity to convince a young generation that, yes, we did it.
Terrific. I want to thank Laurence and Todd, who have incredibly busy schedules, including, unfortunately, tonight for Todd. But I know that I'm going to enjoy spending more time with Laurence this evening. It was terrific to see you all here. Our thanks to our friends at the French Embassy, who have been such a big part of the our lecture series for so many years, and all of you for coming today. Thank you.